I'm going to begin rather from the bottom of page 16. I'm going to skip over the second to last paragraph. It just says that the funeral for President Harrison was happening. You'll remember that we're in Washington, D.C., and that Solomon Northup has come here with two men named Hamilton and Brown, who run a circus, sort of, and they want him to play music for the circus, although we haven't seen the circus yet. I'm going to start from the bottom of 16. From early in the morning, I was constantly in the company of Hamilton and Brown. They were the only persons I knew in Washington. We stood together as the funeral pomp passed by. I remember distinctly how the window glass would break and rattle to the ground after each report of the cannon they were firing in the burial ground. We went to the Capitol and walked a long time about the grounds. In the afternoon, they strolled toward the President's house, all the time keeping me near to them and pointing out various places of interest. As yet, I had seen nothing of the circus. In fact, I had thought of it but little, if at all, amidst the excitement of the day. So they're just like spending the day in Washington. You can imagine it's the President's funeral. It's a pretty big deal. My friends, he means Hamilton and Brown, and I think he's saying it ironically. My friends, several times during the afternoon, entered drinking saloons and called for liquor. They went to bars. They were by no means in the habit, however, so far as I knew them, of indulging to excess. On these occasions, after serving themselves, they would pour out a glass and hand it to me. I did not become intoxicated, as may be inferred from what subsequently occurred. So he says, during the day they went around to a few different bars. They went in. Nobody was getting drunk. They were having just like one drink or part of a drink and moving on. And sometimes they would buy him a drink too. Remember, this is in Washington, D.C., where they are. They're not near his home. Towards the evening, and soon after partaking of one of these portions, I began to experience most unpleasant sensations. So he's going to tell us what happened to him, but he didn't get drunk. It's something else, okay? I felt extremely ill. My head commenced aching, a dull, heavy pain, inexpressibly disagreeable. At the supper table, I was without appetite. The sight and flavor of food was nauseous. About dark, the same servant conducted me to the room I had occupied the previous night. Brown and Hamilton advised me to retire, commiserating me kindly and expressing hopes that I would be better in the morning. Divesting myself of coat and boots merely, I threw myself upon the bed. It was impossible to sleep. The pain in my head continued to increase until it became almost unbearable. So he's having this incredible headache, this incredibly painful headache. And so he just like takes off his coat and his boots, but he like goes to bed in the rest of his clothes because he feels so awful. But he can't sleep because of the terrible headache. In a short time, I became thirsty. My lips were parched. I could think of nothing but water, of lakes and flowing rivers, of brooks where I had stopped to drink, and of the dripping bucket rising with its cool and overflowing nectar from the bottom of the well. Towards midnight, as near as I could judge, I arose, unable longer to bear such intensity of thirst. So he's like, I can't take it anymore. I gotta get something to drink. I was a stranger in the house and knew nothing of its apartments. There was no one up, as I could observe. Groping about at random, I knew not where, I found the way at last to a kitchen in the basement. Two or three colored servants were moving through it, one of whom, a woman, gave me two glasses of water. It afforded me momentary relief, but by the time I had reached my room again, the same burning desire of drink, the same tormenting thirst had again returned. It was even more torturing than before, as was also the wild pain in my head, if such a thing could be. I was in sore distress, in most excruciating agony. So he has this horrific headache, this undying thirst. He just cannot stop. I seemed to stand on the brink of madness. He felt like he was going crazy. The memory of that night of the horrible suffering will follow me to the grave. In the course of an hour or more after my return from the kitchen, I was conscious of someone entering my room. There seemed to be several, a mingling of various voices, but how many or who they were, I cannot tell. Whether Brown and Hamilton were among them is a mere matter of conjecture. So he doesn't know if the people who came into his room this later in the evening were Brown and Hamilton and other people, or if they weren't a part of it at all. I only remember with any degree of distinctness that I was told it was necessary to go to a physician and procure medicine, and that pulling on my boots without coat or hat, I followed them through a long passageway or alley into the open street. It ran out at right angles from Pennsylvania Avenue. On the opposite side, there was a light burning in a window. My impression was that there were three persons with me, but it is altogether indefinite and vague, and like the memory of some painful dream. So he doesn't really know who was there. He thinks it was three people. He knows they went out to the street. You know, his memory's foggy because he's not feeling well. Going towards the light, which I imagined proceeded from a physician's office, and which seemed to recede as I advanced, is the last glimmering recollection I can now recall. From that moment, I was insensible. How long I remained in that condition, whether only that night or many days and nights, I do not know. But when consciousness returned, I found myself alone, in utter darkness, and in chains. This is a pretty big deal. He remembers going out to the street. He remembers seeing a light in the distance, this a light at a maybe at a doctor's office, and every time he thought he was getting closer, the light was farther away, and that's the last he remembers. And when he wakes up, he's in total darkness, alone, and wearing chains. The pain in my head had subsided in a measure, but I was very faint and weak. I was sitting upon a low bench made of rough boards, and without coat or hat. I was handcuffed. Around my ankles were also a pair of heavy fetters. So he's got, around his wrists, he has handcuffs, and around his feet, he has the same kind of thing around his ankles. One end of a chain was fashioned to a large ring on the floor, the others to the fetters on my ankles. So there's a chain attached to the floor and attached to his ankle cuffs, which are called fetters. Where was I? Oh, sorry. I tried in vain to stand upon my feet. Waking from such a painful trance, it was some time before I could collect my thoughts. Where was I? What was the meaning of these chains? Where were Brown and Hamilton? What had I done to deserve imprisonment in such a dungeon? I could not comprehend. There was a blank of some indefinite period preceding my awakening in that lonely place, the events of which the utmost stretch of memory was unable to recall. I listened intently for some sign or sound of life, but nothing broke the oppressive silence save the clinking of my chains whenever I chanced to move. I spoke aloud, but the sound of my voice startled me. I felt of my pockets. Okay, so here he is. It's total darkness. He's sort of talking out loud because he just doesn't really even know what's going on. He can't hear anything. He doesn't know what happened in that time when he was unconscious. I felt of my pockets so far as the fetters would allow, far enough indeed to ascertain that I had not only been robbed of liberty, robbed of his freedom, but that my money and free papers were gone as well. Then did the idea begin to break upon my mind, at first dim and confused, that I had been kidnapped. But that, I thought, was incredible. There must have been some misapprehension, some unfortunate mistake. It could not be that a free citizen of New York, who had wronged no man nor violated any law, should be dealt with thus inhumanly. The more I contemplated my situation, however, the more I became confirmed in my suspicions. It was a desolate thought indeed. I felt there was no trust or mercy in unfeeling man, and commending myself to the God of the oppressed, bowed my head upon my fettered hands and wept most bitterly. So he figures out, like, there's got to have been some mistake. I'm a free man. I couldn't possibly have to, you know, be imprisoned. But he realizes he's been kidnapped. And now he is a prisoner, and he doesn't know what's going to happen for him. That's the end of chapter 2.